for our next story, which seems ripped from the pages of science fiction, it's not. Snap's Anna Adlerstein travels deep into the suburbs to figure out what one young man is actually made of.
I first heard about the repository for journal choice when I was a 10-year-old.
This is David Plotz. He's a journalist and author. And our story begins when David was a kid sitting at the kitchen table.
My father, who is a scientist, was reading the newspaper, and he suddenly burst out with anger that it was the kind of project that Hitler would do, trying to create super children.
At the time, David didn't really know what his dad was talking about. But 20 years later, when David was working for Slate magazine, an article came across his desk that mentioned the repository.
The repository was founded by Robert Graham, who you haven't heard of, but you probably are the beneficiary of his work. He had invented shatterproof plastic eyeglasses, and he became obsessed with the idea that too many stupid people were having children. He was going to create a sperm bank for geniuses. And I thought, well, what ever happened with that? I remembered my father's rage. I decided to dig into this sperm bank, which was commonly called, it was called the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank, but its official name was the Repository for Germinal Choice. About a month after I started reporting on the repository, I got an email from a kid. And he wanted my help.
Growing up, I was always suspicious that there was something being kept hidden from me and that it had to do with my dad.
Here's Tom. He's asked us to use a different name to protect his identity. And when Tom was a teenager, growing up in the suburbs in the 90s, he and his father had a very turbulent relationship.
He basically just told me I was going to fail at everything that I tried. I feared becoming my dad when I grew up. I didn't want to turn into the abusive monster that he was. I didn't want to follow the same path as him.
But all the paths he was considering seemed pretty unrealistic.
Oh, I wanted to be a professional rapper, a wrestler.
Especially to his mom. She would tell him,
I know you're capable of better than this. You have more potential. And then I'd say, well, why? Why do you know I have more potential than that? And she would back up a little bit, but she wouldn't tell me the real reason why she knew.
Then, one day when he was 15, he, his mom, and his sister were on a family vacation. He pulled his mom aside, and he finally got the secret out of her.
She told me that my father that I grew up with could not have kids, and that she really wanted them. Yeah, and then she told me, you hit the genetic lottery. You know? It doesn't get any better.
As his mom talked, everything he knew about himself was coming into focus. So this is why he couldn't relate to his dad, and how he coasted through school without trying.
It's insane how far your mind can run away from you. I knew my mom was intelligent, so if my dad was some crazy inventor or Nobel Prize winning genius, then I assumed I was going to be too.
Tom was so excited to figure out who his dad was. He asked his mom which sperm donor she'd picked. She said there might be some paperwork back home, but that right then and there, she couldn't remember.
I walked out of her on breakfast, and I immediately went to a computer because I was trying to get answers that she didn't have.
Tom learned all about the Genius Sperm Bank. He was one of only 200 babies conceived from the repository, and he found out that a few of the nation's greatest inventors were associated with it. He almost couldn't believe his luck.
Yeah, he's either Jonas Salk or he invented the transistor. Either way, he's somebody who's important, who's a genius, who's in history books.
Once he got home, he obsessed over finding the original donor paperwork. He ripped through his mom's desk, and he tore apart the attic.
My mom keeps everything. Every scrap of paper that ever floats across her desk, she has it. I finally got angry enough that I took all of the files out of the cabinets and just threw them on the floor. And then it's like, oh, there's a manila folder at the bottom of the drawer. This is it. Now I'm going to take this to my mom, and she's going to pick out the one that's my dad, and I'm going to know. I'm going to know which donor is my dad, and then I can start trying to track down who the real person is behind this sheet of paper. She looked through it for a minute, and she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I just don't know. This was 1984 when I picked this out. I just don't know. I'm sorry. I'm not sure which one it is." I flipped out on her. I just lost it. And I said, "How could you be so irresponsible as to not even keep track of which one my real father is? You couldn't even take a highlighter to it? You couldn't write somewhere this one and set it aside somewhere different? Why is this even in the folder with all the other ones?" I flipped out and I left. At the time, my mom was working from home. I walked into her office. I noticed that her desk was clean, and the only thing on it was the one sheet of paper. And then she told me I spoke with so-and-so at the repository who used to work there. They looked it up. They've confirmed it. This is your real dad. And she gave me the piece of paper. I did tell her thank you. I folded it up, I put it in my wallet, and I left. As soon as I was out of sight from her, I just opened it up, unfolded it, and committed it to memory as fast as possible, just in case something happened and I lost it again. The piece of paper said at the top, "Donor Coral 36. It said that he'd written a book. It said that he had a genius level IQ tested at a young age, and that he was one of the top people in his field. I kept that in my wallet, folded up, and I looked at it every day. Every day. At some point, I would pull it out of my wallet, unfold it, and just read the whole thing. Eyes blue, height 6 foot, and I just try to somehow divine what I had no way of knowing by looking over the same piece of paper I'd read over and over again.
Tom reached out to David Plotz, the writer researching the repository. David didn't have any answers for him, but he was excited to help look for his dad. In the meantime, Tom had a lot of bragging to do. He began to tell his friends at school.
Yeah, I wanted them all, I wanted everybody to know. I began to take school more seriously. I began to actually do the homework. Even though I didn't need to do it to grasp the subject matter, I did it anyway, just to show the teacher that I had a grasp on it, so they'd give me the A that I needed to get into MIT or Harvard or wherever else I was going to go. You know, you're already at the age where you're trying to pick your career and trying to figure out what you're going to do with your life, and it makes it even harder when you think, oh, I might be the genius that cures cancer if I go into medical school, or I might be the genius that creates the next, you know, mass media storage device. It paralyzed me with fear of picking the wrong field to go into. It made it so hard to pick a career, you have no idea. I imagined scenarios in which my real dad would seek me out and maybe not even tell me he's my real dad, just, you know, check up on me. And if I wasn't doing good enough, he wouldn't tell me. He'd just come by and see me working at McDonald's or something and just drive on by through the window. Whereas if I was a chemist or if I was a lawyer, maybe he might look me up and he'd come find me and he'd want to be around me. He'd want to tell me, oh, you're my son, let's hang out and go fishing. Let's do all the stuff we never did, you know? Graduation day, it was the brightest, sunniest, best day you could ever imagine. We threw our hats in the air. I graduated a year early. I had 1 year of college already done towards my associate's degree. It felt like I was on my way to fulfilling some kind of genius prophecy. The day after I graduated, I got a phone call from my girlfriend. She told me I missed my period. I'm pretty sure I'm pregnant. And I said, "You're kidding me. Oh my God, really?" I didn't believe it until I saw the plus sign. I thought that I was completely invincible. I thought that this just was not the sort of thing that happens to the next inventor of the transistor. There is no possible way that I was going to end up, you know, a teen pregnancy statistic.
But it was happening. Tom and his girlfriend Lana found themselves broke with a baby on the way.
We had to go sign up for Medicaid. One of the forms was the family tree. That was one of the first ones they gave us. And I didn't know what to put for half my tree. Even worse than that, my mom doesn't know who her real father is. My dad that raised me has no idea who his real father is. So between me, my dad, my mom, and my sister, we were a family of bastards. Nobody knew who their dad was. And the family tree was a mostly blank piece of paper.
The idea of Nobel Prizes and an Ivy League future now seemed a world away. But just when he thought it couldn't get any worse...
My mom's house burned down 3 days after my son was born. The folder that I had spent so much trouble trying to find and that was so important to me to find was ash. The only real proof that I even had that any of that was even real, that it happened, was that I still had the one folded up piece of paper in my wallet.
Tom had just about resigned himself to the fact that he was never going to figure out who his father really was. But then he got a call from David Plotz.
And he tells me, I found him. I found your real father. I know who he is.
Tom's father is a man we'll call Jeremy. Jeremy was not a Nobel Prize winner. In fact, none of the Nobel laureates associated with the repository were good sperm donors. They were just too old. Instead, the founder, Robert Graham, looked to Plan B.
Robert Graham started branching out and going to the colleges and trying to just find people who seemed like they would eventually become Nobel Prize winners and people who were doing well in their field.
Jeremy went to law school and ended up as an attorney in Florida. Tom took comfort knowing that while his dad might not technically be a Nobel Prize winner, he was still made of the same stuff. He could barely wait to meet him.
I slept a deeper sleep and a more restful sleep than most people will ever know. I was on cloud nine.
Tom flew to Florida with Lana and the baby. They rented a car and drove for what felt like forever. Finally, they pulled up to a row of houses.
When we got to his house, at first we were looking around like, this really isn't the nicest neighborhood. I don't know if this is the right place. We finally found the right house. Or the right side of the house and the right entrance, and it's the place was kind of dirty and not really what I expected for someone who was a lawyer. So we go around, we knock on the door, and he answers. He came through the door wearing a Hawaiian shirt that was all the way unbuttoned and flip-flops. Looked a dead ringer for me. Obvious that we were related. And I went to shake his hand, and it was covered in watermelon. And I couldn't shake his hand because I didn't want it to get sticky. We ended up just giving hugs instead. And I was giving him a hug, and I was thinking he's probably putting watermelon on the back of my shirt. After that, it just got worse from there. His house, I hate to say it, especially... you know, recorded on radio forever, but it was a mess. There's mice and cockroaches, and, you know, dirt and old plates that had, you know, food on them, and basically thinking to myself, how did I get here? It didn't seem like, I didn't even want to put my son down on the floor to let him crawl around or anything. I didn't, like, okay, we're going back to the motel now. And I felt bad, too, because he's being so friendly, saying, oh, you guys can stay here tonight. And it's like, I'm not sleeping here. No.
Jeremy was a personal injury lawyer. and he would have been doing all right financially if it wasn't for all of the child support.
He had 6 ex-wives and over 18 kids through those failed marriages and countless other ones through the repository.
Jeremy told him that when the lady from the repository had asked for his IQ, he just told her what she wanted to hear. Tom didn't know how to process this. The man whose genes he shared wasn't a genius. He wasn't anything. The idea that he would be just like his father, his biological father, this is what had kept him going.
There was a short car ride where we got the chance to talk alone. And he turned off the music and got quiet for a second and then told me, he said, I'm sorry about the way your dad was while you were growing up. If that had been me, I would have been different. I told him, I said, you know, I worry about turning into him sometimes because I don't want to ever be like that with my son. He said, you don't ever have to worry about that. You don't have to turn out like your dad that raised you. You don't have to turn out like me. It's entirely within your power. It's in your hands. I was without words. I felt just an epiphany. This was exactly everything that he said is what I needed to hear. It's everything that I was looking for, and no one had been able to give that to me up to that point. In this one respect, at least, he was a great father.
Days, Tom is the proud father of 2, runs a successful roofing business, and a decade later, he's still married to his high school sweetheart. We're proud of you, Tom. Thanks so much for sharing your story. And thanks as well to David Plott, the author of the book, The Genius Factory, The Curious History of the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank. To read more about Tom and to get the full scoop on the Repository for Germinal Choice, we'll have a link to David's book on our website, snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Anna Adlerstein with sound design by Renzo Goria. Okay, so I didn't know why my parents were acting so weird. Hopping around, hovering. I didn't know why, but they told me that a man's going to be stopping by soon. And I was to act normal towards this man. Act normally. I was to open the door, ask him to have a seat, see if he wanted anything to drink. Why wouldn't I act normal? Who's the guy? What's the big deal? Do we owe him money? Does he know a secret? Are we in his will? And why don't they just open the door themselves? But I'll wait. And I'll wait. And finally, there's a knock on the door. I open it. And standing in front of me is a man. A tall man in a gray suit with dark holes where his eyes should have been. And I scream at the top of my 10-year-old lungs and I slam the door hard. Glenn! Glenn, what did you do? My mother rushes out, opens the door. Mr. Cully, I'm so sorry. I see the man in the gray suit trying to shove sunglasses on his face. Oh, no. It's my fault entirely. I still hear myself screaming. Then I see the man move his cane back and forth as he enters our home. And I shut up. What had I just done? What was wrong with me? How could I treat somebody like that?
Glenn, will you please get Mr. Gully something to drink? And maybe you have something you want to say to him now? I place a glass of cold orange juice in front of Mr. Gully. I'm sorry about that. I thought you were somebody else.
Really? Whom did you think I was?
And I don't have an answer. I can't tell him that I feel like I'd been waiting for a long time for something from under the bed, from out of the shadow, from inside the mirror. I just realized I had been waiting for a very long time for someone. In that moment, I figured that he was him. Now then, we're going to start off today's Snap Judgment episode with a story where the search to solve one mystery turns into the search for something else altogether. Buckle yourself up. Snap Judgment.
My romantic notion was my father had to have been a sailor in a port of call, a very large, famous port of call, New Orleans. And my mother might have likely been a one-night stand, and I was a result of that. And back then, in my little world, my conservative Bible Belt world I grew up in, that was a far-fetched notion. But knowing what I've discovered, boy, how conservative was my romantic notion now.
For the longest time, Gary knew absolutely nothing about his birth parents. He let go of any hope of ever meeting them, but he told himself he had two adoptive parents at home who've given him everything. He became an electrical engineer, he married, and had a son of his own. Then out of the blue, when Gary was 39, his parents had something to tell him.
I prepared myself for the worst. I thought we were going to hear some bad news about someone in the family. But when they announced that my birth mother, or a lady from San Francisco, had contacted them claiming to be my birth mother, boy, my insides were just jumping. I was so excited. This was likely the most exciting news I had ever heard in my life.
It was only a matter of months before Gary and his son Zach flew to San Francisco to meet his birth mom, Judy. What followed was a family reunion Gary had always dreamed of. He met his grandmother, his aunts and uncles, and his half-brother. But the next day, when he and Judy were driving east across the San Francisco Bay Bridge, something occurred to Gary, a question he had completely forgotten to ask.
It's like, well, this is great. This is your half of the family. So, Mom, whatever happened, who was my father? And she was driving in her little red Grand Am, and I was in the passenger seat. She adjusted her two-hand grip on the steering wheel and set up straight in her seat. And her whole demeanor changed, because I really don't think she was expecting that question right at that time. But she said, well, honey, it's been a long time. And I was very young. And so I was forced to suppress my memories about my time with you and your father. But all I remember was his name was Van.
What Judy tells him about Van is very far from Gary's romantic notion of his father. When Gary was just weeks old, his father would leave him unattended, lying in a trunk.
When she would come home from work, he would intentionally have the lid closed and just mumble something about sick of hearing it cry. And she told me it wasn't just about the crying. He did not want her breastfeeding me. He did not want her holding me.
One morning, Van grabbed the crying baby from Judy's arms and ran out the front door. he took a train to Baton Rouge and abandoned the baby on a stairwell of a random apartment building.
And then she said, when he returned home without you, I left him immediately. And that's a whole lot to digest in 3 minutes. We hadn't gotten to the end of the Bay Bridge yet. And I mean, this is information overload. Wasn't expecting any of that. I don't know what I was expecting. Having my own son, I just can't fathom the soullessness of a father to be able to do that. I told her, I said, you know, Mom, I really don't think I want to meet this guy. The color returned to her face. And she later admitted, I'm glad you decided you didn't want to find your father.
Gary flies back to Baton Rouge, but no matter how hard he tries, he can't stop thinking about his biological father.
That's when I said, you know what, I want to know. This relationship with my mother has turned out to be something out of a dream. And certainly, if this reunion can be this fulfilling, I'm positive that I can have a wonderful experience with the man who gave me life.
Judy reluctantly agrees to help Gary, and turns out she has contacts at the San Francisco Police Department. Her late husband was a homicide inspector for years. His partner was now a sergeant on the force, and seemingly happy to provide Judy with some information.
She said, honey, your father's name is Earl Van Best Jr. And he gave me his social security number, his date of birth, his place of birth, and his mother's maiden name. At the end, she said, honey, there's information in your father's file that he is not going to share with you. Just hearing my father's name for the first time was just so overwhelming to me. I was just thrilled to have his name, and my mind just zoomed by that little caveat. I didn't care. As it turned out, that file and the information in that file would certainly become a very critical part of my story.
Gary's distracted by one other thing. The sergeant has just sent him an email of an old DMV photo from 1962 of his father.
And this picture starts downloading on my screen. And from top to bottom, the first thing I see is how much darker his hair is than mine. And my son's looking over my shoulder. And the next thing I noticed was his eyes. They just looked lifeless. I mean, no emotion. And Zach says, Dad, he looks like a serial killer. And I'm like, no, he doesn't. You know, wanting to be protective of this photo, this father that I'd never met, never seen. And so here I am looking at a DMV photo of my biological father for the first time. But I go back to the eyes. It looks soulless, like there's no soul behind. You know, they say the soul, the eyes are the key to the soul, the window to the soul. I think that's what they say. But it's true. Why the look? But it's okay. You know, that didn't deter me. I'm just thinking, this is a picture. This is my father. I'm going to go find him.
But the first thing Gary finds is that his father died 20 years back.
But I still had to know. I still wanted to find out, you know, more about his family and see what they knew, see how much they knew about me, see what they knew about him. So I didn't give up.
He urges Judy to contact her friends at the San Francisco Police Department again, and this time ask about the contents of his father's file. Maybe what's in there will shed some light.
My mom went and met the now former chief of the San Francisco Police Department. And he told her, Judy, what Gary's father went on to do would make what he did to you and Gary
seem inconsequential. The information in Gary's father's file is so heinous that it would destroy you. So you tell Gary to drop it. I am so beaten down. I've got no energy left. And when she called, I told her, you know what, Mom? I'm done. I'm done. And I did. I dropped it. That day, that was April 6th, 2004. And on July 31st, 2004, having completely forced every memory of my father, every hope of ever finding out what the real story was, I turn on the television and see this wanted poster from the San Francisco Police Department from a cold case, and the hair stands up on the back of my neck like it's doing right now. And I just, maybe I let out an audible something, because my son comes running from his room in his Xbox or PlayStation, and he says, he sees I'm looking at the TV. I guess he sees the color drain from my face. He says, Dad, it's you.
The 40-year search for the Zodiac Killer remains a mystifying cold case.
Zodiac, a symbol that now stands for terror in San Francisco.
To this day, police have never arrested a suspect. The Zodiac went on to claim he was responsible for more than three dozen killings.
This guy is a pathological, psycho killer. There's no doubt about it.
Gary's watching a news special on the Zodiac Killer, who terrorized California in the late 60s. His victims mainly women, but what really made the Zodiac infamous is the way he'd openly taunt the police. He'd send cryptic messages or ciphers to the press, claiming that they contained his identity. No one ever cracked that code. But the mystery surrounding the Zodiac was so enticing, it inspired a huge cult following, with hundreds of conspiracy theorists claiming they know who the real killer is. And although the authorities never caught him, they do have a sketch of the Zodiac's face, which is now on display on Gary's TV screen.
I got up from my chair and I walked to my office and I picked up the framed photo now. Remember, this was still a driver's license photo, as far as I've been told. I bring it into the living room and I show Zach. I was like, oh my God, this surely has to be the most unfortunate coincidence possible. My father looks like the Zodiac Killer.
Now, if you look at the sketch of the Zodiac and the DMV photo of Gary's father side by side, the physical similarities are hard to deny. The large forehead, the dead eyes looking through black-rimmed glasses, the narrow nose, thin lips, even the unfazed expression. Right away, Gary thinks back to the statement from the last police officer his mom spoke to.
What your father did was so heinous it would destroy you. So I started thinking about that definition of heinous as it pertains to a homicide unit or a police department. What could it be? You know, what could it be more heinous than child abuse, child abandonment? It had to be something.
So all I had was that hunch.
Gary begins to do some research, this time determined to get to the bottom of his father's story.
Knowing that I will find something in an old family document or from his friend in high school or in the police reports or something. Someone's going to come out of the woodwork and say, you know what? Your father wasn't even here in the country when this occurred, so it couldn't be him.
The first thing he finds is that the police department's main Zodiac suspect was a man by the name of Arthur Lee Allen. He was a pedophile who actually claimed to know who the Zodiac Killer was. He said he met him at a mental hospital in Central California for the sexually deviant. Turns out, Gary's father was kept in the same hospital for statutory rape. Gary also learns his father spent the first 6 years of his life in Japan, where his own father taught him a certain coding system that's eerily similar to that of the Zodiac ciphers. So then one day, Gary decides to sit down and closely study those ciphers. And basically, they look like a child's word search puzzle. But instead of the pure alphabet, they contain some letters interspersed with numbers, math symbols, and geometric shapes.
I just grabbed my pen and wrote out E-A-R-L-V-A-N-B-E-S-T-J-R. The way he spelled his name there and the way he spelled his name as he did on the booking sheet with the SFPD, E.V. Best Jr.
And like a word search puzzle, Gary looks for each letter of his father's name vertically, diagonally, and across. And there it is.
The Zodiac says, in this cipher, you will find my identity. And had my father's name in the two different ways he wrote his name, with no letter substitution, with no missing letters, a complete layout of his name in two different ciphers. That's when I knew.
And I have to ask, at some level, did you want to believe your father was a Zodiac?
You know, I didn't set out to prove my father was a serial killer. So at some level, did I ever hope that he was? Absolutely not. I certainly did not want this to be true.
By this point, Gary has clicked on an article from the San Francisco Chronicle that says a Zodiac killer case was recently made inactive.
At the bottom of that article, I saw a note that said, however, if anyone has any credible leads or tips, they should contact a certain lieutenant in the Homicide Bureau, and gave his phone number. And there it was. There was my opportunity.
Some people might say all of this sounds pretty outlandish and even unbelievable, right? So I have to ask Gary, is he just another guy with his own pet theory?
Believe me, being a professional engineer, business person, family man, father, I absolutely had reservations about coming forward, but I wasn't going to join the cult following. I have a case. I am more ready now than ever to find out one way or another. I believe I'm right, and I hope I'm wrong. And there's one piece of information that I could have that could disprove it completely for me, and that is my father's file. So I called the number. Surprisingly, he answered the phone, and I said, Lieutenant, my name is Gary Stewart. And I have a question. Has the Zodiac case been solved and closed? And he laughed. he laughed. He said, no, it's not solved. I wish it were. I said, well, I have some information, and maybe you can help me.
The next chance he gets, Gary flies to San Francisco to meet with the lieutenant in person.
I sat in his office, and he took out a little notepad, and he says, okay, let's go over this one more time. And I believe by the time I got finished sharing the overwhelming, compelling evidence that I had, he said, you know what, Gary? There's only one way to get down to the bottom of this. Will you voluntarily submit a sample of your DNA for analysis, for comparison to the alleged Zodiac profile we have? And I said, sure. And he swabbed me that day. Part of me was very sad, trying to figure out how I was going to come to terms with this. Part of it was elation and relief, knowing there was nothing else I could do, and hope and pray to God that it comes back negative.
But to this day, the truth still escapes Gary. He says his case was mysteriously shut down, and the lieutenant he spoke to ultimately transferred out of homicide. He still has a copy of the crime lab request to have his DNA compared to the Zodiac's. I reached out to the San Francisco Police Department. They didn't respond in time to my questions about Gary, but say the Zodiac Killer case is open and active. For Gary, this has all come at a cost. He didn't tell his birth mom, Judy, he was still digging into his father's past. He didn't want to upset her. But when he finally shared with her what he was up to...
She made the statement, "Honey, I wish I would never have searched for you now." And I'm thinking, really? And that hurt. I mean, how do you think that makes me feel? And she would say, "Oh, honey, I didn't mean that I... But I just, if I had known that there were going to be so many unanswered questions and that I would never be able to give you all the answers you needed, nor the father you deserved, I would have never looked for you."
Gary's relationship with Judy has been on the rocks ever since. In a way, Gary's kind of back where he started, no closer to the mother or the father who gave him up.
Understand, Nancy, that the only reason I ever started this journey was so that I could have a chance to have a cup of coffee with this man and tell him, you know, look at me, look at my life, look at who I've become.
And so, Gary, after learning what you know about your father, knowing what you know now, is he still someone you'd want to have a cup of coffee with?
That's a tough question. And now, completely believing that he was the Zodiac Killer, I would just want to know why. I have my theory, I have my justification about the way he was raised and losing his father and his mother's philandering, but I would like to have a conversation with him. And I don't know, Nancy, if you or your listeners will be able to understand that. That's just, I think everybody wants to hear their parents' voice at one time. I know that'll never happen.
It wasn't until a few years ago that Gary realized there was one other thing he could do. He found out where his father was buried and decided to pay him a visit.
He was interred, one of 16 buried that day in this poor pauper's cemetery. I didn't have flowers. I came with a heavy heart. I prayed really hard that God would forgive me for the anger that I had for my father, for what he had done to me. Like I said, it was personal for me, because even though him abandoning me was the best thing that ever happened to me, it's still hard to swallow. Sorry. That your biological father didn't love you enough to keep you. And I guess it was 4, 5, 6 minutes I sat there I realized, you know, tears were streaming down my face, and I'm like, you know what? This is it. You know, he used to keep me in a box because he hated to hear me cry. And now he was in a box, and I had a captive audience, and I was crying. A son to meet his father for the very first and last time.
Gary Stewart for sharing your story. To learn more about Gary and his father's backstory, because there is a lot more, check out his book, The Most Dangerous Animal of All. We'll have a link at snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Nancy Lopez with sound design by Leon Morimoto and Pat Lacidi Miller.